So I would like to welcome Adam Hunt. He's a writer for Full Circle Magazine, and he writes Linux operating system and application reviews. A monthly online presentation is Full Circle Magazine, and it focuses on Ubuntu and operating systems. He also was a volunteer at the National Capital Freenet for over a decade. And tonight, Adam is going to be talking to us about free software. What can it do for you? And with that, Adam, it's all yours.
Great. So hopefully you can hear me.
Yep.
And I think I just have to hit share screen, and that should bring up the presentation, right?
Yep. You have to do the twice share screen. The bottom right corner of the sharing screen has a share button as well.
There we go. I think we're
there. There we go. Yep,
that got it. Showing up?
Yes, it is.
I even get a little legend that says participants can now see your presentation. Okay. All right. So we'll just launch into it. And I guess I'm the only one who gets to talk. So, so my presentation is called Free Software, What Can It Do For You? And as Chris indicated, I'm a volunteer writer for Full Circle Magazine, which is a free magazine that comes out monthly. It's actually published out of Scotland, but there's writers from all over the world contribute, and none of us have met each other. It's all done remotely, so which is kind of neat. We just communicate by email and other means and send our stuff in. So I'll start off by just covering the licensing, which I put at the bottom of the screen here. And I said this presentation is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 2.5 Canada license. But I will point out some of the screenshots I'm going to show you are licensed under the GNU Public License 2+, Mozilla Public License, or the BSD license, or other free licenses. So basically everything you see here can be reused by anybody as long as you attribute it and put it out under the same kind of license. So let's move on to there we go. Okay, just figuring out how to advance things here. It's a little different. So I wrote this presentation especially for you guys, the Ottawa PC Users Group. And I'll start off by saying there's no need to take notes here. I know probably most of you are furious note takers, but what I did was I put together a PDF sheet of links. So everything I mentioned in the presentation where there's links online, that'll be in the PDF sheet. And also there's a PDF copy of this presentation, which Chris has said he's going to put up when we're done here. And so you'll be able to download both of those. So I'll start off by saying, we're talking about free software, but you may already be using free software. So here's an example here of the Firefox web browser, which is obviously a common item of free software, application software. And this one that I've got the screenshot of is actually being used on Windows. And you can tell by the little control buttons in the top right. And as I said, you probably already are. A lot of popular applications are free software like Firefox. But there's a lot of free software that's probably in your life that you're not even aware of. A good example is most DSL and cable modems that you use to get internet into your house, they're running Linux. Android phones are all Linux. And most of the internet's web servers run Apache on top of Linux. If you've ever been on an airplane, like an airliner, the pilot gets all his weather information and all the ATC systems are all, that's air traffic control, are all run on Red Hat Linux. I was on a tour of NAV Canada's computer center here in Ottawa a few years ago and wasn't totally surprised to find that the whole thing is run strictly on Linux. And the picture at the bottom right there shows a server farm. That's pretty much what it looked like. And I have a little flip phone that I use for cell phone, and it runs a thing called AOSP, which is the Android Open Source Project, which is Linux. And if you've got a smart thermostat in your house, almost guarantee it runs Linux. Smart fridges run Linux, and so on and so forth. So you probably already got a lot of free software in your life. I thought we'd talk about the fact that lots of software is available for free, but there's different kinds of free. There's free as in free beer, in other words, stuff you don't have to pay for, and then there's free as in freedom. That's one of the problems with the English language is the word free often means different things. French, for those of you who speak French, you know that there's two words for it, gratuit, which means something that's at no cost, and libre, which is something that promotes freedom or is associated with freedom. But in English, we get the words a little confused. So let's start with what is free software. So we'll talk about the different kinds of software you can get for free. So there's, for instance, there's proprietary software, costs money. A good example is Microsoft Office. It's proprietary software under a proprietary license, and you have to pay for it. And then you get what's called proprietary freeware, like Google Chrome, which is software that's not under a free license, but it's given away for free. And then you get things like proprietary shareware, which includes adware, crippleware, trialware, nagware, and freemium software. And I'll just quickly touch on what those are because there's some interesting terms. Adware is software you can get for free, but it's supported by advertising, and there may be pop-up ads in the software, or it may have advertising banners. Crippleware is things that are basically disabled, and you can pay extra to get versions that work better. Trialware are often things like, the software is free, but only for 30 days. And at the end of 30 days, it either goes poof or you get to pay for it. Nagware is kind of similar. It's where it's free, but they constantly bug you to send them money. And sometimes you can close those screens for a while, and sometimes you can't. And then freemium is another term you hear, which is, again, very similar to crippleware, which is where there's a simple version of something that doesn't cost you anything. And then there's an enhanced version which has more features that you have to pay for. So in a way, with premium software, the free version is really advertising for the paid version, and they hope at least some people are going to pay for it. So let's talk about free software. And here we're talking free as in freedom, not free as in free beer, although most free software is also free of charge for sort of structural reasons we can get into a bit later. So the Free Software Foundation has a definition of what they consider free software. So the first thing is what they call Freedom Zero, which is the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose, including for commercial purposes. The freedom to study how the program works and to change it so that you're as you wish, Freedom One. And access to the source code is a precondition for this. So the source code has to be available. Freedom Two is the freedom to redistribute copies so you can help others, the ability to give it away. And the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions to others, which is freedom three. And by this, you can give the whole community a chance to benefit from your changes. Access to the source code is a precondition for this. And one of the things I'll say about free software is a lot of it is developed collaboratively, because when you give away the source code and you give away copies of the software, other people can try it out. And if they find there's things that aren't working or things that could work better, then they can work on them and send you the code back, and you can incorporate it. And in fact, that's why free software often improves so quickly, is because people look at it and go, "Oh, no, we can do better than that." And they'll write something and send it back. So just a quick look at some of the free licenses, because there's a whole bunch of different ones. Probably the most popular and common one is the GNU Public License, which was written by Richard Stallman back in the 1980s. There's also the BSD license, which is a license that's used for the source code for Google Chrome. And it's an interesting license in that it doesn't impose anything on people. It's basically, here it is, it's free, do whatever you want with it. And there's no requirement to give back or to redistribute under the same license. So you can take stuff under the BSD license and distribute it as all rights reserved software, which is essentially what Google does with Google Chrome. They take the Chromium browser underneath it, which is under a BSD license, and then they put it out under their own Google Terms of Service. The Mozilla Public License is another one that's used for most of Mozilla software like Firefox and Thunderbird email. And there's a lot of other licenses too. The thing I'll leave you with is that licensing matters. That's what really guarantees the freedom of the software, and make sure that you've got the source code and that people can review it, and that way they'll know it's, what it does and how it works, and that it's safe to use. So let's look at, with that sort of background, let's go on and look at some applications that are available for Windows, and we'll look at some free software operating systems at the end. Now, I understand probably most of the members of the club here are using Windows and perhaps Mac, and I know some of you are using Linux systems, but we're going to start by looking at some free software applications that are specifically available for Windows. So I'll start off by saying there are literally thousands of free software applications available for Windows users and for just about any purpose. And I've picked out a couple of dozen here that we're just going to have look at some screenshots are, and I think you'd be surprised at the kind of purposes that these have. So I'll also have most of these are better designed and work better than a lot of proprietary software. And there's a good reason for that. In a lot of cases, there's a lot more people working on these than you'll find working on proprietary software. Often at companies that produce their own software and sell it, there's only a small number of people working on it. With free software, you can end up with one person working on it, dozens, hundreds, thousands. And because the code is available, it means that it's been audited, which generally means there should be no spyware, no ads, and no malware in it. And you say, well, why no ads? And this is actually one of the strengths of free software. Let's say I wrote a piece of free software to do something, and I decided to put an ad in it. Well, somebody else will take the source code and issue it without the ad. Bing, it's gone. And that's the strength of free software. And everybody will use his version and not mine because there's no ads in it. So it's a sort of a purifying process. Now, some free software are professional projects, entirely using, like paid developers, and some are volunteer. A lot of companies, when they're developing software for their own use, they'll open source it or make it free software so they can get help from outside. They know that other people look at it, look at the source code, and contribute stuff just on a volunteer basis. So it's a way of actually saving money and getting your project to be a higher quality much quicker. And it benefits everyone. So let's look at 28 applications for Windows. So I picked the number 28 is not particularly magic. Like I said, there's thousands here, but these are ones I'm all familiar with and I know what they do and how they work. And I got pictures of them. So as I said here, all of these have been tested and recommended either by me or by a group we have at National Capital Freenet that I started called the NCF Free Software Group, which is just a group of people, kind of like your own club here. We have a chat space and we just discuss free software. And when people find something that works, they recommend it and I put it on the list. And the list is one of those things you'll find on that PDF that I promised you at the end of this presentation. So I think I put these in alphabetical order, so we're starting here with A. So we start with Audacity. Audacity is an audio editor. So if you're taking audio tracks like music and combining them together or spoken voice, this is a good program for it. Audacity has been around for a long time. It's quite well developed. A lot of professionals actually use it, and it's been used to produce some professional music albums. Particularly, a number of rock groups have specifically used it because they like using free software. So I've used it to edit audio programs, particularly for later combination in video. And Audacity is it's a nice piece of software. Moving on to C. This is Calibre, which is an ebook reader. So it's a free ebook reader, allows you to organize and read your ebooks. And as you can see, it's got a fairly simple interface. I've never used this, but some of my friends on the free software group have, and they rave about it and say it's very simple to use and it presents your books in a nice readable fashion. Also under C is Clamwin. Clam is actually an anti-malware. It was originally a command line anti-malware, which is why it was called Clam. And Clamwin means it's Clam for Windows. So here's a picture of an earlier version of it running on Windows. And it's a Windows specific program. And it uses an antivirus search engine that's all free software, along with free software definitions for this. I actually use a very similar version of this on Linux, and it works really well. This has a very nice GUI. It's easy to set up, and you can set it up to run scans in the middle of the night when you're not using the computer. By the way, this is the only free software for Windows that does antivirus. So moving on to the letter F, this is FileZilla. This is a piece of software I use almost every day to run my own website. So this is a file transfer program, which allows you to transfer files from your computer to, in this case, a web server. But you can actually transfer files from anywhere to anywhere else that'll accept them. FileZilla, again, has been around for a long time. It's kind of interesting in that it's actually developed by just one person. And he's been doing it for many, many years. And he seems to make a living actually doing this using donations and some other work that he does. But a great piece of software. And again, this is one that's available for Linux, Mac, and also for Windows. Still under F, of course, we come back to Firefox, which is a web browser. These days, most people consider it probably the best web browser, especially for privacy. It's highly customizable. You can make it look and work almost any way you want. It's got thousands and thousands of extensions you can add on to it that can add all kinds of functionality. One of the ones I use is called uBlock Origin, which is an extension that's a wide spectrum ad blocker. It even makes YouTube totally usable. There's no ads on my YouTube when I use that. Anyway, Firefox has been around for a long time. It's developed by a company called Mozilla, which is a nonprofit. And last time I checked, they had about 1,400 people working on it. They actually get money from Google because they put up Google as their main search engine, although you can easily change it. I don't use Google. I always change it when I set up Firefox. But they get most of their money that way, and they also get some money from donations, and it enables them to develop this. So moving on to G, this is GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program. So it's an image editor. It's pretty much as powerful as Photoshop. It has a huge number of features. One of its strengths, though, is it also has an amazing amount of documentation. They have an online documentation that's written in very simple language. So it's a complete user manual that's actually easy to understand. For instance, if you want to look up how to draw a straight line, it'll explain it to you in like seven easy steps. So it's really good for a beginner who comes to this. Now, I say it's probably as powerful as Photoshop. And of course, it's free, unlike Photoshop, which you basically these days have to rent by the month. It doesn't, some of the ways it works are a little different from Photoshop. So if you've used Photoshop or other image editors, there's always a bit of a learning curve with any of them. But this one is cross-platform. Again, it's found in Linux. It's available, again, for Apple, Macs, and it's available for Windows. GNU Cash. So this is actually an accounting program that's a double-entry bookkeeping system. As I said, there's free software for almost any purpose. I haven't used this one, but I know some accountants who've used it, and they say it's as good as any double-entry bookkeeping system for doing like home business or for doing your home accounts. The use of the term GNU, by the way, is again to the original project that resulted in GNU and Linux. So you'll see that name come up quite a bit. Here's an interesting program called GRAMPS, which is actually a genealogy program. If any of you are into plotting family trees and researching your ancestors, this program actually is generally thought of as being pretty good. As you can see, it produces some interesting diagrams as well as the actual trees that we're more used to seeing. I've talked to a few people who've done genealogy, and they quite like it. They think it's pretty good. And of course, the price is right compared to a lot of the other ones, which can get quite expensive. Moving on to the letter I, this is Inkscape, which is it's another image program, but this one is used to create what's called vector graphics, which are SVGs. And as you can see, this particular one, somebody's drawn a bicycle here and labeled all the parts. I've actually used Inkscape, and like a lot of vector editors, it takes a little while to get used to it, but once you get into it, you can produce quite amazing diagrams and pictures. And of course, it produces them as SVGs, which are very small files that can have a lot of detail for a small file size. It also has the ability to export them into JPEGs, PNGs, and other images that are more commonly used on the web. So moving on to J, this is actually a program I've used quite a bit in the past. JEdit is a Java-based editor for, it's a text editor. Text editors, of course, are used to write web pages and also to do coding. This one has so many features and plugins and additions that I know a few people who've actually done software coding on it, and they quite like it because it's simple and it has a lot of tools. It's not quite what you call an integrated development environment, which includes a lot of cross-checking and stuff, but for a text editor, it's pretty powerful. And it also has a lot of plugins, like you can add all kinds of features to it very simply. And if you don't need the other features, then you don't need to add them. And as you can see in this example, it has syntax highlighting, which is very useful for a lot of coding, including when you're writing HTML, enables you to pick up errors very quickly. So I've used that one quite a bit in the past. I'm actually using one called gEdit these days for writing web pages, which is a simpler text editor, but has everything I need. But gEdit, highly recommend it. Moving on to K. Here's a program I use all the time. This is KdenLive, which stands for KDE Nonlinear Editor. And KDE is the cool desktop environment, which is one of the desktop environments you'll find on Linux. So this is a video editor where you can take video clips, put them all together there on the left side of the screen, and then edit them together to make movies. You can also edit the audio. It's gone through a lot of development in the last few years, and it's actually a very powerful editor. I consider it actually the best video editor that's available on Linux, and it's probably the best one you can get, certainly the best one you can get for free for Windows. It's very simple to use, and it has really good documentation. Again, it's got an online user manual that explains how to do things in great detail, which is very helpful when you're beginning. If any of you have done video editing, you find that each video editor can be quite different from the others. And so there's always a bit of a learning curve when you're learning something new. I've been using this one for years after going through about a dozen other video editors, all of which run satisfactory. And this one actually works, and it produces really nice product. Quite a lot of my videos I've produced are up on YouTube. And one of the nice things is it's able to output in a whole variety of formats, including some free software formats, including the native format that YouTube uses, which is WebM, which is a free format that Google invented. Still in the K's, this is KeePass, which is keep your password safe. So it's a password manager that keeps all your passwords locally, unlike some password managers that have been offered as services online and have been compromised in recent years. This one stays on your local computer, and it keeps your passwords organized and safe. I know quite a few people have used it, say it's very simple to use, and it works very well. Still in the case, this is Krita. Krita is a free software program that's mostly used for painting. So it has a wide variety of brushes and palettes and things like that. And I know quite a few people have used it. I have one friend online, actually, in the U.S. who uses Krita to paint basically photo-quality pictures of birds. As you can see, the example here is obviously an anime illustration. But if you're into creating art, particularly if you paint with a brush and you'd like to try digital art, this is a great way to get started. Krita, again, is it's not just a beginner tool, though. It has a lot of sort of full features that allow you to create just about any kind of painting you like. Again, it's got pretty good documentation, and there's, I believe, online communities that can help you share stuff and also learn about how to use it. Out of the K's and into the L's, here's a piece of software that probably a lot of you are already using, or at least have tried. This is LibreOffice, which is a complete office suite. This is actually the launch page for it here, and you can see that it there's a word processor, there's a spreadsheet, there's a presentation program, there is a vector graphics drawing program, a database program, and a math formula writer. And so this is the launch page for it. So in a lot of ways, this is competing with Microsoft Office, and in fact, that's what it was originally designed to compete with, except, of course, it's free. I've tried Microsoft Office in the past. I definitely prefer LibreOffice. It has a lot more features built into it. For instance, it has the native ability to produce PDFs right from within each program without any add-ons or extras. And it produces very nice PDFs too. So let's look at what it's made up of. So here's LibreOffice Writer, which is the word processor. And in fact, there's a document I was working on, which is the list of links that you're going to be able to download later on. So I just thought I'd do a screenshot of that and put it up here. So as you can see, looking at it, it has all the normal features you'd expect of a word processor at the top. You can choose your fonts. And it includes spell checking and automatic links and everything else. So it works very similar to any other word processor. You can also use it for creating desktop publishing because it has built-in powerful tools for laying out pictures and creating like PDF books and things out of it. LibreOffice Calc is the name of the spreadsheet program. This is not my screenshot. This is one I got, but it shows a lot of different features. So it's a spreadsheet, so you can keep your home accounts on it. It can produce all kinds of graphs, including, as you can see, bar graphs, line graphs, pie charts, and things like that. It's one of the programs I use all the time for a lot of different things. Particularly, I keep my home accounts on one of these, including I make graphs. LibreOffice Impress is kind of similar to PowerPoint. And as I note, that's what this presentation was created on. And in fact, there's a shot of me creating this page that it was created on. And if you find this presentation simple and easy to follow, that's the work of LibreOffice Impress. Every time I use it, actually, I'm actually very impressed with how simple and quick it is to produce presentations. So if you ever have to make a presentation to a computer club, this is certainly an easy way to do it. LibreOffice Draw is a vector graphics editor, so it's a little bit like other vector graphics creators. It's a bit complex, but there is an entire manual on how to use it, and you can produce your own graphics through this. And again, it's used for creating scaled vector graphics SVG files. LibreOffice Base is their database program. It's probably the least used one, and it's often omitted from installations when the LibreOffice is installed on Linux distributions. They often leave this one out. You can always install it. But I guess these days a lot of people aren't using databases as much as they were 20 years ago, so it's not a big thing. But if you have a need to create databases, then LibreOffice Base certainly can do it for you. The one thing I'll throw in is the last time I checked, it was not compatible with Microsoft MDB files, which are what's created by Microsoft Office. But it has its own particular open source file format for creating databases, which are compatible with a lot of other applications. I have used it, but not extensively. And here's one I've actually never used. It's one component of LibreOffice called LibreOffice Math. It's a math formula writer. There's a whole manual for how to do this. I guess this is very helpful if you're creating like papers that involve mathematical formula where you need to write something like that and then insert it. Personally, it's not an area I'm involved with, but anyone who does that kind of work will probably appreciate the kind of stuff you can do with this. And I think, as you can see by the interface here, you basically code it and it produces it. And then you can transfer the illustration into your other documents. So moving on from LibreOffice into the M's here. This is a graphics editor that I use a lot called MT Paint. It's a little bit like Photoshop, but it's much simpler. And I use it mostly for photo editing. And in fact, that's a screenshot I did. And that's actually a picture of me at Lac Philippe last winter doing a little cross-country skiing. My fiance snapped the picture. And I just thought it was probably a good illustration of what MT Paint can do. The reason I like this program is it's extremely easy to use. It's got documentation that explains how to do everything. But because it has limited number of features, it's really quite quick to learn how to use it. And for a photo editor, for fixing up your pictures, it's really hard to beat. It's very quick, simple, and easy to use, and opens really quickly. Opens in about a quarter of a second. Anyone who does astronomy has probably come across this one. This is called Stellarium, which is a desktop planetarium program. These are actually two screenshots side by side I put up here. On the left is the general interface for it, and it allows you to look around the sky and zoom in on objects. So on the left screen, you can see it's zoomed in on the moon. And in this case, there's actually an information graphic there, which just happens to be in partly in German, at least, but it does give you an idea how it looks. On the right side of the screen, there's a general view, which you would see in the daytime. Now, you can move time back and forth, so even if you're looking at it in the daytime in real time, you can move the time forward and see what's in the evening sky. But I like this display because it shows the constellations, and it also has a feature where it shows the illustrations of the constellations. So if you're just learning constellations and locations, it kind of allows it a little easier to sort of visualize what you're looking at. I've used this quite a bit in the past, not in recent years. But as desktop planetariums go, it's pretty powerful. It's a lot of fun to use, and it's one of those things you can sit down with your kids and teach them, or grandkids, and sit down and teach them what's in the night sky, you know, how to find that comet that was in the news, that kind of stuff. Still in the S's, this is a program for Windows only called Sumatra PDF. So it's a PDF reader. It's a pretty simple PDF reader, but it opens really quickly, works way better than most of the other ones. And you can see on the left side of the screen, it's got the chapters in this particular publication, which is a 25-page publication about DNA. But it does a good job displaying it. It's developed by one guy who I believe lives in Germany. Now, I was saying earlier, you'd be surprised what kind of free software programs there are. And this is one I've never used, but I know some people have used it. It's called Sweet Home 3D, and it's a program for interior design. And it's not a professional program designed for interior designers to help you design your house. It's mostly for homeowners or people who are looking at building a home to design interiors for your house and to figure out decor and furniture and stuff like that. So again, it's two screens here, and I put them both up because I think they kind of get what this particular program will do. So the left screen there shows just some of the elements and how they're organized, and you can like drag and drop chairs into place. You can see too, there's a sort of a plan view of a house, including the garage with the cars in it, and then there's sort of a view of the room, and you can check and add things. Or remove things. The right-hand screen shows sort of the finished product when you've put together a room, and you can render that and say, okay, here's what I want my rooms to look like. And you can fit all the furniture into it and the widescreen TVs and everything else. So, like I said, I haven't personally used this, but I know some people who actually did do it to redecorate parts of their house. And they were fairly impressed that it was easy to use and came up with a good product that they could actually work with. So from there we move into Thunderbird. So this is another product from Mozilla, the company that also produces Firefox. And this is a free email client. And so it's actually very flexible. You can lay it out a bunch of different ways. This one is laid out with navigation on the left, list of email there just to the left of center, and then actual email on the right screen. But it can be reconfigured in a lot of different ways. This is another one of those pieces of free software you may already be using because this one is immensely popular. Okay, from Thunderbird, we move to Transmission. So Transmission is actually a BitTorrent client. And I think I shot this picture because, no, I didn't. It's in German. Definitely not me. But I think this picture shows downloading a bunch of Linux ISOs, which are files for installing Linux. So somebody here is downloading a whole bunch of them all at the same time. But it's a good illustration because even though it's in German, it does show progress bars for a whole bunch of different things. So if you use BitTorrent at all, I use it all the time as part of my software reviewing because I'm always downloading Linux distributions to review them. Then this one is a very simple and powerful BitTorrent client. Next, move on to Ventoy. This is actually not a piece of software you install on your computer. Ventoy is actually developed by a Chinese developer. And again, he's working on this pretty much on his own, I think. This is actually something you install on a USB stick, and it enables you to test other pieces of software, in particular to test Linux distributions. But it can also be used for booting up Windows and other things. So if you look at the list here, this is actually the boot screen. He's got a whole bunch of different things on there, including Debian and down at the bottom, Windows 10 and Windows 11. Pretty much anything that you can get as an ISO file, what you do is once you've installed Ventoy on a USB stick, then the next thing you do is you can just drag and drop any ISO files onto it. And then when you boot to the USB stick, it'll bring up this screen and you have a choice of which one you want to bring up and have a look at. It's really useful for reviewers if you're doing software reviews. So I use this software all the time when I'm working on reviews for Full Circle. But it's also for people who want to check out different Linux distributions or different versions of Windows and different operating systems. It's a very quick way to be able to check these and bring them up, test them out, try them, maybe do some screenshots and then reboot it, bring up another one and test it. So a very powerful tool. In the past, we've had USB writers that'll write ISO files onto USBs, but usually it'll only write one. So you write it, test it, and then you have to erase it and start all over again with a new one, which makes it a much more cumbersome process. And this particular program, Ventoy, makes that whole program process really fast. You can dump as many on there as will fit on the USB stick, and then just boot to them one at a time and check them out. So I use this all the time in my software reviews. So I thought I'd put it up here because it's kind of an interesting particular piece of free software. And it'll run on any particular operating system at all because it's not installed. You just put it on the USB stick. Still in the Vs, this is VLC. which actually stands for Video LAN Client, and LAN, of course, meaning Local Area Network. So it's a media player. It will play music and it will play video. And in this case, it's got multiple screens. So I'll just explain the one at the bottom left that has its name on it and the traffic cone. That's just the information screen, which gives the version. The traffic cone is actually the icon or the representative image that they use as an icon for VLC. And it's because this was actually developed at the École Polytechnique in Paris by a group of students. And they had a hobby of stealing traffic cones and hiding them in their rooms. So when they took this on as a student project, the traffic cone ended up as their symbol. So just above the traffic cone there, you'll see a video window. And on the right side is a play screen window. So that will be a list of things. In this case, it's just one video that's sitting there. I've used VLC quite a lot, and it makes an excellent music player. It has built-in controls that allow you to change your music profiles and even a graphic equalizer, which is useful for changing the music profile to fit your speaker system. And it's an excellent video player. It'll play just about any kind of video you can imagine. And even with a couple of plugins, you can play encrypted DVDs and things like that on it. So we're in the Vs. And that it brings us to the end of the 28 different bits of application software that that you can run on Windows. So I was asked to do a little bit about free software operating systems at the end, because not only are there applications that are free software that you can get and run for free, but there are also entire operating systems. And of course, there's Linux, there's BSD, which stands for Berkeley Software Distribution, because it was first developed at the University of California in Berkeley, and then Solaris and other Unix-based systems. And then there's a bunch of oddball other ones, including Fuchsia, which has a kernel called Zircon in it. And over on the right there, I've got the penguin, which is, of course, the image of the icon or mascot of Linux. And below that, there's a coffee mug with a little demon on it, which is the BSD logo. And he's called Beastie, like BSD. So you'll see his picture show up. And, of course, the Linux penguin shows up all over the place. So let's just have a look at free software operating systems for a couple of minutes. So where do you find these? Well, first off, if you have an Android phone, you're already running Linux, because Android is Linux, developed by Google and based on top of the Linux kernel. If you have a Chromebook like this and you're running Google Chrome operating system, then you're already running Linux as well, because Google Chrome is based on a Linux distribution, and that runs the Linux kernel as well. For anyone who hasn't used Google Chrome, these are generally laptops that run the Chrome browser, and you do everything online, including using Google Docs for your word processing and that sort of thing. They're simple, they're very fast to boot up, and they're just about bomb-proof, pretty much indestructible to malware, which is a good thing. But you'll find Linux other places too. Here's a photograph of a thermostat, and yeah, there's that penguin again. So in this case, it seems to have come up with a boot-up screen. But a lot of smart Internet of Things devices, including security systems and other things, are actually running Linux behind the scenes. And yep, I even found a picture of a refrigerator here. It's called the Samsung Linux Touchscreen Fridge. Of course, there's a joke in the Linux world that you can run Doom, you know, the first-person shooter game, on anything that'll run Linux. So people joke about running Doom on their fridges. And this one you probably could. It's got the screen for it. Yep, and this is even a thing too. There are cars out there driving around today that are running Linux instead of other systems. I'm not sure what model of car this is, but when it was shot, it was definitely running Linux. But of course, what we're really looking at today, and what we're interested in, is Linux on the desktop, which is, these are Linux distributions that you can put on your laptop or on your desktop computer and run them. So this picture on this screen is actually the computer I'm using to talk to you right now. And so it's a used Dell Latitude 7490 that I got last year, which is a business class computer, but I got it used, so I got it cheap. And it's running a distribution called Ubuntu Cinnamon, which is a version of Ubuntu. I'm going to show you a few more pictures of that a little bit later on. So I thought I'd throw this in. What people think Linux users look like. But what Linux users really look like. And I thought this was a great picture. Now, obviously, the person in this picture is actually a developer because otherwise she wouldn't be wearing that t-shirt. But I thought the bumper sticker on it was probably a good point. And judging by the badge on it, she's running Debian on that. And of course, so how hard is Linux to use? Well, this is what people think it looks like. But in fact, here's a Linux desktop. This is actually Debian. And I think you can see it's a little more friendly. There's some icons on the left. There's a launch bar on the bottom. This one's set up with a launcher, so it looks and works a bit like Apple. These days, Linux distributions that are used for desktop tend to be extremely user-friendly. So people would say, so why would you want to put Linux on a computer? So there's a bunch of reasons. First off, no cost. You can get it for free. It's more secure. It's way more secure than Windows and more secure than just about anything else. It's stable, doesn't tend to crash. I often run my desktop without a reboot for a month or more, and usually it just gets rebooted when there's a kernel update. There's no crapware. If you've ever had a fresh installation of Windows or some other commercial ones, you often get all kinds of icons on the desktop. Buy this, sign up for that. There's none of that. Drivers are all included in the Linux kernel, so everything tends to work right out of the box. Easy updates. The update systems tend to be, you can set them so they automatically update in the background. You can set them so that your updates, you have to check them all and approve them all. They tend to be extremely configurable. And of course, one of the best things is you can run Linux on old hardware. A lot of the main distributions these days will easily run on just about anything that ran Linux, Windows 7. But there are distributions out there specifically aimed at old hardware. And there's still distributions, new distributions around today that you can run on hardware that was designed for Windows XP or even earlier sort of hardware and still get a reasonable desktop and get some work done. So some more reasons. There's no need to pirate software. Most Linux distributions have access to what we call repositories, which are great collections of application software. For instance, in the Ubuntu family, there's about 40,000 applications available through the repositories that you can pick and install. Most Linux distributions have tons of choices and allow lots of customization, some less than others, and we'll cover a couple of those. Some are more aimed at business uses and they don't have so much customization. Others, you can customize them to look like just about anything you want. One of the big advantages of Linux is, unlike some operating systems, they don't slow down over time and get bogged. My fiance actually had a desktop computer a few years ago that took 45 minutes to boot up. I won't mention what operating system it was running, but I replaced it with a Linux system and it booted up in under 2 minutes. There's no backdoors or other access to your computer within Linux. Support is free. In general, there's no professional support, but there's usually forums and things where you can get answers. These days, because Linux is so mature, most of the operating systems that use Linux are so mature, almost any question you have has probably already been answered. And so very often you don't have to ask a question and wait for an answer. All you have to do is search for the problem you have, and somebody's probably already answered it. I certainly found that in the last few years. I haven't had to ask questions in quite a while. But even if you do, there's user forums, usually for each specific operating system. And very often you'll find you get the answers within minutes. And as I said, months without a reboot. And that's a reality. There's actually some Linux servers that have never been rebooted. Some of them have been run for more than 10 years, and they can do kernel updates and things on the fly. They never need rebooting because they never crash. And, oh yeah, did I mention it's free? That might be a selling point. And there's some gratuitous penguins. So, who actually uses desktop Linux? It's just for geeks, right? Well, actually, a lot of organizations use it. There's thousands of organizations. There's an article on Wikipedia which actually lists a lot. But just to name a few you've probably heard of, Nav Canada, which is the organization that runs air traffic control and the aviation weather system in Canada. They exclusively use Red Hat Linux. Federal Aviation Administration actually was using Windows XP years ago. And when Windows Vista came up, they decided to move to Red Hat Enterprise Linux as well. The US Navy, the US Army also use Red Hat. The Indian court system uses Ubuntu, and so does the French Parliament runs on it. And there's hundreds and hundreds of other organizations that run it. One question people ask is how many Linux distributions are out there? There's a website called DistroWatch, which is sort of a catalog of Linux distributions. And it ranks, last time I checked it a couple of weeks ago, it had 275 main list distributions on its list. And I say these are main distributions. There are thousands more. Wikipedia has articles on an awful lot of them. Some of them are short, some are extremely long. And I find when I talk to people who've been running Mac or using Windows, they're a bit bewildered by the amount of choice that you have on Linux. But Linux is all about choice. One of the things I always say is there's a lot of distributions, Linux distributions out there, and not every distribution is for everyone, but there is a distribution for everyone. And if you look around, you'll probably find one that's perfect for your needs. But it won't be the same one as anyone else is running or everyone else is running. Choice is a good thing, but it can be a bit bewildering when you start off, especially if you've got a computer you want to install it on, and you're trying to find the perfect distribution. So I guess I should probably start off by saying, what's a desktop? When we talk about desktop Linux or Linux on the desktop. Now, every computer that you have, on a lap, any operating system you have on a laptop or a desktop type computer has a desktop. But the desktop is the collection of front end software. It's the stuff you, basically everything you see. So the menu system, the applications, and the real core to a lot of the desktop is really the file manager, because that's the one thing they tend to build them around. So the picture on the right side of the screen here is Fedora, which is actually the basis for Red Hat Linux. And it shows some items on the desktop, including the actual desktop behind it. So let's just touch on some Linux distributions, which I'm familiar with and which I write about. And we'll just take a quick peek at those. So Ubuntu, probably most people have heard of, even if they haven't used it. Ubuntu's actually been around for 20 years now and highly successful. It's used by a lot of organizations. I was in a medical office actually a year or two ago, and they always show you into the office and say, "Wait here, the doctor will be with you eventually." And so I was kind of looking around the room, and there was a computer there, and what was it running? Ubuntu. No, I didn't touch it. I just looked at it. This particular picture shows Ubuntu. This was a recent release that came out in October. Ubuntu comes out actually twice a year with new versions. And this one was called Mantic Minotaur, which is why there's a labyrinth with a Minotaur on it. This desktop uses a launcher system, kind of similar to what Macs use. The launcher is up the left-hand side, completely configurable. This is actually the menu system. So when you click on it to go and look for applications, you can either type to search them, or you can just look through your list of menu items. So there's just some things that are installed by default on Ubuntu. And you can see there's some games, calendars, video player. It comes with just about everything you need to get started, including LibreOffice. And you can see some of those showing up there. Oh, and Mahjong. A lot of them actually come with a few sample games, but in the repositories, there's hundreds of games along with hundreds of other programs. And here's a look at Ubuntu showing its file browser, which is called Nautilus or GNOME Files. So that probably looks familiar to almost anyone who's used a computer, because it looks and works pretty much like everything else. So Ubuntu actually spawned a whole bunch of other distributions. It's a very solid sort of back, the rear end on it, the back end on it, it's very solid. And a lot of people decided they wanted to run other desktops on it. And the first one that was done was called Kubuntu, which uses the KDE desktop. So it's KDE desktop on top of Ubuntu. They called it Kubuntu. And so here's a picture of Kubuntu 23.10, which came out last October. Again, these are all issued every 6 months as a new version. And so this one is it's a menu-driven one. So it looks very familiar to Windows users. There's a little button down in the bottom left there with a little gear icon on it. You click that, and it brings up a menu. And in fact, there's the menu. And so for Windows users, this is probably quite familiar. And there is Dolphin, which is the name of the file browser that's used on KDE and on Kubuntu. And again, very similar sort of features to what almost anyone's used to. These days, there's not a lot of learning curve to moving from Mac or from Windows to any Linux distribution. You'll find that there's been a sort of convergence in what people want in them, and so a lot of them actually will seem very familiar. So let's move on to one that I used for a number of years. This is called Lubuntu, which is originally it was the LXDE desktop on Ubuntu, and these days it's called LXQT. And so this one they like purple and blue themes. And there's that Minotaur again. So this is again a menu-driven version of Ubuntu. There's the menus. It's got sort of a multiple menu system, kind of like Windows had in the old days. So very simple to use, easy to learn. And there it is with PCMan FM, which is the name of its file browser. It's actually developed by a guy in Taiwan. And this project is run, there's quite a few people from France involved in it, some people from Taiwan, and some people in the US who work on it. So it's a real international effort. It's fairly lightweight, so it can be run very nicely on old Windows XP hardware. Certainly on Windows 7, it'll work very well. Here's another version of Ubuntu. This one uses a desktop called Budgie, which is a sort of a hybrid desktop. It has a launcher, as you can see, but it also has a menuing system. And they tend to go for kind of cosmic wallpapers there. Again, like you can on any desktop, if you don't like those, you can certainly change them to your favorite wallpaper. So there's the menu system. This one's kind of neat in that it has a couple of ways of displaying the menu. You can show icons, or you can show lists of applications. Easily configurable back and forth. And this one actually uses a file browser called Nemo. But again, probably looks very familiar to anyone who's used a file browser to look for files. So this is the actual operating system I'm using these days called Ubuntu Cinnamon, which is Ubuntu with the Cinnamon desktop on it. It's a menu-driven system that's, again, really simple and easy to use. They tend to go for kind of cinnamon colors as well. So there's the menu for Ubuntu Cinnamon. One of the neat things about it that I like is that the menu's resizable. You can make it as big or as small as you want. That's sort of the default size right there. And it uses the Nemo file browser, which was actually written for the Cinnamon desktop. So there's a picture of a couple of examples of Nemo. Another member of the Ubuntu family is called Mate. I know it looks like it's spelled mate, but it's actually comes from South America, and it's named after a drink, a highly caffeinated kind of tea there called mate. And they tend to like green colors. This is a very traditional one. It's got a simple menu system. Makes it easy to find things. And as you can see at the bottom in this picture, you also have an optional launcher. If you like launchers, you can pop that up and use that. I'm not a big fan of launchers, but I know people who do like them, particularly if they come from the Mac world. And there is its file browser. And again, pretty familiar stuff. Another member of the Ubuntu family is Ubuntu Unity, which uses the old Unity desktop, which was actually used by Ubuntu itself a few years ago. And again, it's a launcher-based system. There's that Minotaur again. And it has a pop-down menu where you can look for anything that you can't immediately launch off the launcher. And this also uses the Nemo file browser. The developer actually who does this is 15 years old and he lives in India and he's got a whole team together and they work on this together. He actually started this when he was 12. Here's Zubuntu, which is the XFCE desktop on top of Ubuntu. Kind of a funny bit of wallpaper there. I think it's supposed to be a constellation, but in my review of this, I noted that the top left, it looks like a guitar pick to me, but I could be wrong. So Zubuntu has, again, a simple menu system called Whisker. And There is Thunar, which is its file browser system. I'll just touch on a couple ones outside the Ubuntu family. Those are the ones I'm most familiar with because in the magazine I write for Full Circle, we mostly concentrate on Ubuntu family, reviews of Ubuntu family distributions. But there's a couple of other neat ones here. This is kind of a creepy looking desktop with a spider on it called SlyTaz. And it's actually a super lightweight desktop. It uses the LXDE desktop. And SlyTaz will actually run on very old hardware. It runs very nice on old Windows XP hardware. It'll probably run on even older hardware than that. It uses hardly any RAM at all. And yet it's fully featured. It has just about everything you need. And there it is with its file browsers open. Some of the fun things that happen in the Linux world, you're going, wait a minute, that looks like Mac. It's even got the Mac icons on it. This is a strange, it's still current, actually. It's still around, and it's called Ubuntu. So it's sort of, it almost sounds like a spoof of a Mac. But what somebody did was they actually took the KDE desktop and modified it so it looks and works exactly like a Mac. And, yeah, that's Mac wallpaper, and they've created a launcher that looks very much like Mac. So I'm not totally sure who they're aiming it at, but I think it was the intention was if there's some people who would maybe have an old Mac that won't run anymore, won't run, you know, any Mac OS, but they'd like to install Ubuntu on it, or somebody who's looking at getting into Linux kind of softly from running Macs, then this might be a soft way to get them into it and get them used to using it. It's certainly kind of fun. It does show you kind of what can be done in the Linux world. So there's a look at the actual menu system, which looks very much like a Mac again, and even some of the icons. You'll notice the files icon is the little smiley face there on the left, second down. That actually opens the Dolphin file manager, not the Mac Finder, but it uses a very similar looking icon. And there it is with Dolphin open, and a whole bunch of transparency dialed in just to show some effects there. So it's like leaving the Mac world without leaving the Mac world. And of course, somebody had to invent one that would appeal to Windows users. So there's another current one called Wubuntu, which is sort of Windows Ubuntu. And you'd be forgiven for looking at that going, wait a minute, that's got to be Windows 11. It's like it's actually not. But again, it's a KDE desktop that's been sort of modified to look and work like Windows. And again, I think this is mostly aimed at people who'd like to get into Linux but don't want to leave Windows. There's the menu system, which looks pretty similar to Windows 11. You notice, though, the file browser is called Dolphin, which again is the KDE file browser. This one actually incorporates quite a bit of Microsoft software. They've put Microsoft Copilot on it. It comes with, in this case, Microsoft Edge web browser, and it also has Google Chrome installed. And there it is with Dolphin open for its file browser. Anyway, I put that up because I thought it would be kind of fun. I did a review of it recently, and it's an interesting distribution. And all free. So one of the things people say is, okay, let's say you're interested in Linux. How do you get it? Well, one way is to install it yourself if you have an existing computer. And this shows actually a shot from the Ubuntu installer. These days, installing most Linux distributions is extremely easy. It's got a graphical interface on the installer. So all you have to do is go and download the ISO file, put it on the stick, write it to a stick, and then when you click on install, it'll walk you through it page by page, and it's very easy to do for complete beginners. It's also possible to buy computers that already have Linux on it. I have a System 76 computer, which you can buy. I got it mail order from the United States, and it came with that. Purism also make computers like this. Dell actually ship computers with Ubuntu on them. You have to look around on their website a bit to find them and order them, but you can get those. And there's a number of other manufacturers that produce computers already pre-installed with various Linux systems. So in conclusion, There's a big world of high-quality free software out there for Windows and Macs. Plus, there's a lot of free software operating systems if you're looking for a system to get an old computer running again or something to try a little bit different. And I've written, don't miss out. Remember, free software protects your freedom. And there's lots of different ways of getting involved in the whole free software movement. One is to just use free software, get used to it. And if you are the sort of person who can write code, which I'm not, then you can write code and contribute to projects. And as I mentioned earlier, what a lot of people do is they'll try out an application and they go, oh, it's a good idea, but you know, it'd be a lot better if it had this and this. Well, I'll just sit down and write that and I'll send it off to the guy who runs it and he'll put it in, which is often the way these projects work. A lot of the free software projects accept donations. So you can always send them $5 or $10, and that helps, in some cases, it helps hire people to work on stuff. And in fact, some projects have hired summer students in particular to do coding for the summer. But it also helps get volunteers out to conventions and to meetings and things like that. And the other thing you can do is if you've got free software and you've tried it and you like it, promote it, let your friends know about it. Or you can even volunteer to give presentations at computer clubs so you can let people know what's available. So resources. So from this presentation, I'll just mention again that I've provided a PDF file of links. So all those application software items that I mentioned earlier, and also the Linux distributions, I've provided a PDF that has links to it. You can just click on those and go have a look at their pages where there's more documentation and stuff. And there's also a PDF copy of this presentation if you'd like to kind of flip through it and review anything that I've covered here. In particular, if you want to have a closer look at some of the pictures that are included. And that brings us up to questions.
Okay. First thing I'll do is, well, first off, I'd like to thank Adam. It was a great run through of a bunch of software that is available for both Windows and as well as other operating systems. I will go through the questions that have been answered, put into the chat, but right now I'm going to mute all. I can't force it unmute, so I have to mute all, but this time I will give the ability to unmute, and that will include you, Adam. You'll have to unmute yourself again. And the microphones are now available that people can unmute themselves if they want to chime in with any questions. And I'll go through with the comments and questions that were in the chat. I had a question about Calibre. Do you know if it handles all of the ebook formats, including Amazon's? Adam, you're still muted.
Yeah,
There
there we
you
go. I got it. That's a good question. I don't have an answer to that one. I'd have to look
Okay.
that up and get back to you. My understanding is it definitely handles EPUBs and the standard sort of formats like that. I'm not sure how it handles proprietary formats, but that's a good
Okay.
question.
Yeah. Okay. Tom had a question or a comment. Don't forget Scribus for newsletters. So I guess that's another piece of software that's available for page layout type stuff.
And that's a good point. And in fact, as far as I know, Full Circle Magazine is actually laid out on Scribus. So if you go and download your latest PDF issue of Full Circle, it's probably been laid up on Scribus because
Okay,
that's what
cool.
the editor Ronnie I think uses for putting it together.
Okay. And Jeff had some recommendations to add to your list: the Brave browser, Fastone image viewer, Kodi, a media player, and NVDA, non-visual desktop access, which is a screen reader for visual impaired.
Oh, great.
So, if anybody is monitoring the chat, you might want to try out any of those. Karen had a question. Do you have any suggestions for better file management on an Android phone?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually have an Android phone, so I should. But I actually don't use the file browser on it. I just use it for making phone calls and texting.
Okay.
So I actually don't, but one thing about Android is you can actually run almost any Linux application on it. So you could probably actually run like Nemo or even Nautilus on it. I know I saw something kind of funny recently on a chat group where somebody had actually taken an Android phone and installed a Linux distribution on it and was using it for a web server. So
Wow.
yeah, exactly. When you're dealing with Android, there are There is the ability to run just about any Linux software on it, so it should be capable of running a full file browser like Nemo or something like that. But provided you have the RAM to run it, which these days most phones do. Those file browsers don't use a lot. Now, how you get it on there? That's an interesting question. You might have to go to the Android store to do it. But
Okay.
yeah, I think there. I don't think there's any problem getting a better file browser if you don't like the one you have.
Yeah. I think one of the problems with the Android file system is the Android file system. It's really weird the way that they lay out some of this stuff. But anyway,
And that might be the issue rather than the actual file browser. It might
it
be the
could be.
underlying file system here.
Yeah. And Tom makes mention as well of LibreWolf, Iron, and WaterFox browsers. Carol
Iron,
had a
I know we worked with Iron a few years ago. It's actually basically a version of the Chromium browser that's sort of packaged and put together. It used to be pretty good. I haven't actually touched it in the last few years. But it used to be a pretty good sort of example of Chromium that you could use quickly and just install easily on Windows.
And Carol had a question about does Windows interfere with Linux? And I know that there was a reply from Alan about that, and that you can basically access the Windows file system from Linux, not so much the other way around, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. A lot of people, what they do is they will what we call dual boot, right? They'll have a Windows computer and they'll install a Linux distribution like Ubuntu on it, and then it's installed in a dual boot setup, and that allows you to boot. When you reboot, you have your choice of which operating system to boot to, and sometimes there's some interplay between them allowed. And now I know in the last few issues of particularly Windows 10, Windows 11, there's been problems. Windows is trying to block out Linux so it doesn't work, and the dual boots have had problems with that. I've personally never been a big fan of dual booting. I figure if you're going to use a computer, you put one operating system on it and use it. One of the biggest problems I've had with people, especially like Windows users who've installed Linux as a dual boot, is they never boot to it. And I've talked to people a year later and go, "Oh yeah, I've got Ubuntu on this, but I never use it." And so in a lot of ways, it's better if you have a dedicated box and you can just sit down and learn it and use it. These days, the learning curve is pretty quick. There's not that much to learn, even down to the package management and everything else is, like installing applications is all graphical. But yeah, I think before you install a dual boot, you probably want to check out specifically what's going on with that version of Windows and whether it's allowing it. Interestingly enough, by the way, Microsoft has an operating system they use to run all their cloud systems called Azure, and it's Linux. So Microsoft is actually selling Linux right now, and that's something we never thought we'd see 10 years ago.
Yeah, certainly there are some people within Microsoft and that are certainly not averse to using things other than Windows. They'll use what's appropriate for the task at hand. And Mark Marcinovich, is the CTO in charge of Azure, is certainly in that camp. He's a very interesting character.
I imagine how he ever sold Linux to Microsoft, but it's a bit of an endorsement that Microsoft is using Linux and selling it commercially.
For
So.
sure. Yeah. Alan had some comments about the fact that many Linux distros offer long-term support, versions that are supported for 5 years. So I guess if people don't want to upgrade frequently, you can go to the long-term support versions. He
Yeah,
also.
let me just jump on that for a second.
Sure.
No, he's absolutely right. Within the Ubuntu world, which is the corner of Linux that I'm most familiar with, the way Ubuntu works is they put out a new release every 6 months in April and October, and they have a cycle to it. So it starts off with three of the what they call interim releases, and they're only supported for 9 months. But the upgrade is easy. You just basically press one button and it installs the next one right on top of it, and everything still works. But every 2 years in the even numbered years, in April of the even number years, in other words, just a couple of weeks ago, they put out what they call a long-term support version. And in for Ubuntu itself, it comes with 5 years of support, as Alan said. For the other flavors of Ubuntu, like Kubuntu, Lubuntu, Zubuntu, they come with 3 years of support, which will get you through the next one. So every 2 years is a long-term support version. Ubuntu has actually recently added even longer-term support. If you sign up for their what they call Ubuntu Pro program, which is free for the first five computers, you get another 5 years support, And then they also have paid support for an additional 2 years. So you can get up to 12 years of support on it if you want. But that said, it's so easy to upgrade that it's often not worthwhile. Most people don't run the 5 years out on Ubuntu. They'll run the 2 years and then upgrade to the next long-term support. Most of the research I've seen shows that most users these days on the Ubuntu side of the house run the long-term support versions and not the interim versions, unless they have a good reason for it, like they need a newer kernel because they've got a new computer and they need an updated kernel to support the hardware or something like that. So most people are only upgrading their systems every 2 years. And in most cases, it's a very simple upgrade. You just press a button, wait a few minutes, reboot, you're done.
Cool. Alan also mentioned that I guess this is for the people really nervous about trying out Linux. It's easy to try Linux without installing it. Just download the distro and burn it to a bootable USB drive, and then you can have that completely separate from your normal hard drive, and you can try it out without any danger at all of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of those applications, Ventoy, was the one that you install on a USB stick, and then you can drop all the ISO files for any distributions you want on there, and then boot to them and try them all out one at a time. And it boots up into what's called a live session. So it looks like Ubuntu is running on your computer, but it's actually all on the stick and all in RAM, and it doesn't touch your hard drive. Most of them you can actually click through to your hard drive if you want to try opening any documents and see if you can open them and stuff like that. But it runs completely on your computer, but without touching your hard drive or your other operating system. And in fact, when I do my reviews, that's what I do. I put them on a stick with Ventoy. I boot them up, and I test out all the things that need testing out for my review. I do some screenshots, and then I sit down and write my reviews from there. So live sessions are an extremely powerful tool. And with a tool like Ventoy, it's so easy to do. Once you've got Ventoy on a stick, you can just drop your ISO files on there and then try any you like. By the way, I should add there's another little bit of terminology in the Linux world called distro hopping, where somebody will start with a distribution and then they decide that maybe there's a little bit greener grass in the next in the next field, and so they'll switch over to another one, and then they go, oh, this is what I wanted, and then they'll switch to another one, and then after 10, they'll usually end up back where they started. But that's called distro hopping. But tools like Ventoy make distro hopping really easy. You can try out 10 in one evening if you want to sit there and just flip through them all. And pick out the ones perfect for you. And like I said earlier, my opinion is you find if you get on any chats where people are talking about Linux distributions, people always say, "Oh, don't use that one. Use the one I'm using. It's perfect." But it's everyone thinks they have the best one. But as I said, I think there is a Linux distribution for anyone. If you try a few, you'll find one that really feels nice and it feels comfortable and has the kind of features you want and looks and works the way you want, or has the amount of customization in it. Like, for instance, Ubuntu has very little customization. There's only two window theme colors, light and dark, whereas Kubuntu has thousands of customizations. In fact, you better write them down or you'll never be able to duplicate your desktop if you ever reinstall it. And so for some people, they want a lot of customization. Other ones, if you want something that's very simple and doesn't have a lot of customization, just works out of the box, then maybe Ubuntu is better. But as I said, I think there's a Linux distribution for almost anyone and for any purpose. I didn't even get into Linux distributions they use for other things. For instance, there's some that are used just for web servers. You can run them on your car.
Neat. I had a question actually about the file browser. It's like it was something you highlighted on every distro, oh, and it uses this file browser. But wouldn't it be implied that you could actually use any file browser on any distro?
Yeah, you pretty much can. The reason I mentioned it is because most desktops are actually built around the file browser. A good example is Lubuntu. It started off by this developer in Taiwan. He didn't like the other file browsers. He had an old computer and it didn't run very fast. And so he wrote himself a new file browser. And in fact, his username was PC Man. So he called it the PC Man file browser, and it's still called that, PC Man FM. And they then developed an entire desktop around it and, even designed wallpaper for it and everything else. And that became what's now the LXQT desktop, which is used on Lubuntu. So the file browser is kind of the heart of it, but yes. You're absolutely right, Chris. You don't have to use that one. And in fact, I know people who've got Ubuntu, which uses the Nautilus, or it's called GNOME Files. And if you don't like it, they've installed Nemo, and you can do that. there's graphical ways to install these things. You just go and search for it on the software store, install it, and there it is. And then you have your choice. You can use either one. Both of them display all your files. They just display them slightly differently and with slightly different features.
Okay.
So,
Joss had a question actually for you. Any recommendation for a contact management system on Linux to help a secretary on a condo board?
That's a pretty specialized use. That's an excellent yeah. question. I hate to tell you what I use, which is I use Google Contacts because then I can use it right across all my computers. But I'm sure there's just trying to think, probably Thunderbird, like within the Thunderbird email program, it has a complete contact management system, which enables you to keep track of all, you know, contacts and to form users and groups of people for email and stuff like that. That might be a good one to start with. Okay. There's also another email program called Evolution, which has a very extensive contact management system that works within it. I don't know of any that are sort of freestanding, but there probably are some. Like I said, in the Ubuntu world, there's over 40,000 applications, so there's probably something for that.
Right. Alan had a question. He says, any comment on the controversy between GPL 2 and 3? Linus Torvalds has certainly bad-mouthed GPL version 3, but then again, he does that now and again.
Yeah, Linus is the guy who invented the Linux kernel, and he's known for being a bit outspoken. He's actually... he actually lives in California. I've never met him, but I did meet Richard Stallman once on the steps of the Houses of Parliament here in Ottawa. But it's a good question. It's a kind of a complex issue that more affects developers than anything else. When you write a piece of free software, you have to pick the license it's going to be under, and you could put it under the Mozilla public license. You could put it under the free art license. There's hundreds of licenses. Most of them come out under the GPL, the GNU public license. And for years, we used the second version, which is pretty much what everything's structured around. The third version, without getting into too much detail, Richard Stallman added some clauses to it that some developers didn't like. And so a lot of projects did not move to the version 3. And Linus Torvalds was keeping the Linux kernel under version 2 last time I heard. They're compatible licenses. You can use software with either one, either way. From a user point of view, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect the users. You've got the software. It's available for free. You can get the source code. You're allowed to share it. The basic clauses are all the same. From a developer point of view, yeah, this is the sort of thing at developer conferences they get into sort of fist fights over. But from a user point of view, I wouldn't worry too much about the differences between different versions of the licenses. You have the freedom to download the software, to share it, and to look at the source code if you're the sort of person who knows what source code is and what to look for. One of the things I will throw in here, actually, and this is kind of an interesting point, is that, you talk about people who say, oh, I own a copy of Windows 11. It's like, you actually don't. You bought it, you pay for it, but you don't own it. It's the same with Mac software. You have a license to use it, which can be revoked. But when you download a Linux distribution, because it's under these free licenses, you actually own it. You can, you know, burn it to a stick, you can keep it, you can put it on your computer, and it's yours, and it can't be taken away from you. And so you actually own that copy of the software. And it's the same with any, it's the same with Firefox, it's the same with any of the application software. You actually own that copy, it belongs to you. And it's not simply that you paid for it or got it for free and have a license to use it that could be revoked. So it's a bit of a subtle difference, but...
all that subtle.
Yeah, well, it's mostly subtle because it doesn't happen all that often. But
yeah, that's true.
There have been cases, particularly in the ebook world, where devices have come with free ebooks. And I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was an Amazon ebook device where they actually cleaned people's copies of books that they downloaded for free. Ironically, the book that they revoked was 1984 by George Orwell, it was to do with licensing and stuff again. So one of the beauties of free software is you don't run into that. The software is yours. But yeah, there's actually some great articles. There's a Wikipedia article on the controversy between GPL2 and GPL3. And if that's the sort of thing that keeps you awake at night, I would definitely suggest have a read through that.
Okay. Jeff has a question. Any recommendations for a 32-bit Linux distro?
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent question. SlyTaz is available in 32-bit, And Puppy Linux is another one. If you've got a 32-bit computer, I bet you it doesn't have much RAM, and it probably has a single-core processor that isn't too fast, so you need a very light distribution to run on it. Most Linux distributions, I've been using Linux since 2007, and everything was 32-bit back then. Started transferring to 64-bit a little bit later on. And for a long time, you could get downloads for Linux distributions that were either, and you'd download the 64 or the 32-bit. You had to know what your hardware was. A lot of them stopped supporting 32-bit in the last 5 or 6 years. Like Ubuntu, for instance, it's 64. You cannot get it in 32. But to be honest, even if you could get it in 32-bit, it needs a minimum of about 8 gigabytes of RAM to run it. And anything that's 32-bit probably doesn't have 8 gigabytes of RAM. So yeah, I would recommend probably one of the best ones is Slytaz, which was in my presentation. But have a look at Puppy Linux as well too. It's very lightweight. It's kind of fun. It's developed strictly by a group of amateur hobbyists who develop it. And when you boot it up, it barks. It's all dog themed, so if you're not keen on dogs, I wouldn't recommend it. But it's extremely lightweight. Last time I checked it, it was running on like 300 kilobytes of RAM or something for the basic, idle.
Bob asks, would it be okay to ask the name of your YouTube channel? He says he's sure it's equally interesting.
Yeah, actually, most of my YouTube videos are not, they're not software videos. They're mostly sailing and skiing stuff. But if you want to see it, sure. I believe in my document that I supplied, there's a link to my website because I have software reviews on my website. A lot of the pretty much anything I put in Full Circle, I also have different reviews that I've written on my website. And if you go to my website and just go to the homepage, on the navigation bar on the left is a link to my YouTube channel, and you're more than welcome to look at them. Everything's public up there.
Okay, that's great. Also, Bob mentioned, he says, you mentioned you don't use Google Search. What is a better search engine?
Oh, yeah. I have two problems with Google search. First off, I don't think it produces very good results. It produces way too many results, and a lot of them are kind of what we call low quality. It has a problem with search bubbling too, which you may be familiar with. There used to be a party game where you get everyone to take out their phone and do the same search, and everyone would and do the same search on Google search, and everyone would get totally different results. There was one famous example where people would type in Barack Obama's name when he was running for president a few years ago, and one person would get a New York Times article, which was a biography of him as the first result, and the other one would get, "Is Barack Obama really a secret Muslim?" It was all full of, and it's strictly Google bubbling people. It was giving you the kind of answers that you wanted based on the kind of answers to other questions you got. So if you're a big fan of conspiracy theories, all your answers are conspiracy theories. So that was one complaint. So the other complaint was, yeah, just low quality results. And the third problem I have with Google search was, well, it'll come to me here in a second. Oh, the fact that you get tracked, my fiance's done that. It's like, she's looking for a particular item of clothing on Google search, and then it shows up everywhere on every page she goes on. There's ads for it everywhere, and it's like that's because you're being tracked, and your searches are being tracked, and it's being turned into ads that will follow you around the internet until you actually buy that sort of thing. So those are my main complaints about Google search, but perhaps the worst thing is that it just doesn't seem to produce consistently good results. So I use DuckDuckGo as my main one, which is it's become a very good search engine in recent years. It's run out of a place down in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, just over the border, run by a guy named Gabriel Weinberg, who started a few years ago. He actually sold a company and had some money and decided he wanted to make something that was a better search engine. One of the beauties of that is that they don't retain any data. They don't track you at all, and there's no cookies. They don't track you, and everything's totally anonymized. Another good one is Dogpile, which is a meta search engine. It combines other search engines, and also no cookies. And I use Startpage.com occasionally, which is actually a company that basically uses Google results but totally anonymizes them and prevents you from being tracked. I pretty much never use Google search. Occasionally, I do for an image search, like reverse image search use and things like that, because it has a pretty good reverse image search tool.
Okay, cool. Had a question. Is there a Linux version that runs Windows software better than others?
No, that's an excellent question. We have a tool on Linux called Wine, which stands for Wine is not an emulator. It's one of those recursive acronyms that Linux developers think are hilarious. Wine is a compatibility layer that allows you to run a lot of Windows programs. Not all of them work, and not all of them work 100%, but a lot of programs will run on Wine, including quite a lot of games. The one thing I'll add to that is I never use Wine, and I never use Windows programs, because what I find is if you look around, there's almost always something better in free software that's written for Linux, and a lot of it's Linux-only software that actually does whatever you want that you were looking for in a Windows program, probably does it faster, better, and it's free software and not proprietary software. So I can almost always find a better way of doing it using Linux programs, and sometimes you just have to do a general search, and almost always there's something better. So I never run Windows programs.
Yeah. I presume that I already know the answer to this one, but Tom asks if you ever use the Linux subsystem for Windows.
Yeah, no, I actually haven't. I don't have a Windows computer. In fact, that's
on
my biography on Full Circle. It says Adam Hunt lives in Ottawa in a house with no Windows.
Actually, I got an answer to my Caliber question, because
oh,
Bob says that Bob McGowan says from the Caliber website, the built-in editor edits EPUB and Kindle.
Oh, good. There you go.
That's good to know.
Yeah, that's a bonus.
Yeah, and Jose also said Caliber supports Amazon file formats, AZW3, Mobi, and others, and so forth.
Yeah, that's what I was led to believe, is that Caliber actually supports pretty much all the ebook file formats. Yeah. Now, how it deals with DRM is a whole other question, but, you know, digital rights management, in other words, locked files. But...
Yeah. The Tom mentioned for DRM-protected EPUBs in Caliber, you need a DRM remover add-in. I think there isn't one for Amazon, so I guess if there's DRM on the Amazon ebooks, you might be SOL on that. He asks, is there a distro for Tesla cars?
You mean a Tesla car themed distribution? There might be.
I'm not sure.
Or one that interfaces with it. Yeah, it'd be good if you had one that interfaced with it. I don't own a Tesla, so I can't actually answer that question, but it wouldn't be hard to poke around and find out. It depends what you're looking for, if something to interface with it. I know my brother in Vancouver has a Ford Mustang Mach-E, which is an electric car, and he runs it all off his iPhone, right down to the braking, pretty much. So there is some interface there, but yeah, it's a good question.
A little bit out there. Alan makes a mention of the fact that Linux uses a software manager to provide hundreds of secure apps for installation. However, other software can be downloaded and installed as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. We have repositories. Almost every Linux distribution has its own repository. The ones that are related to Ubuntu all use the same repository, which is, you think of it as being a vault of application software that's all available. And you can plug into it using the software manager that comes with it. Most distributions come with a graphical software manager, like a software store, and it makes it extremely easy to, you know, you search for whatever you want on there, whether it's a web browser or a file manager, and it'll give you pictures and descriptions. And a lot of them have, you know, user ratings with stars on them and things like that. So it's very friendly. There's a lot of other ways of managing your software, too. There's also so much more technical managers, which are quicker and more compact, but you know, a little more advanced. I have to admit, I do all my software management off the command line, just because I find it so easy and fast. And when I'm setting up a new distribution, I can use one command, which I just cut and paste in, and it'll install all the software I need in one command. So I don't have to go through checkboxing stuff. A lot of people find the Linux command line kind of intimidating, and you absolutely don't have to use it. There's almost no distributions where you have to learn any commands whatsoever. But for some things, if you learn a couple of commands, you can do a lot of things much, much more quickly. So I can install 20, 30 applications I use and remove another 20 or 30 I don't use, all with two commands, and it just takes a few seconds.
Nice.
Now, the great thing about a command line is that you can script it. You can put it in a bat file for Windows, or a bash file.
Yeah, absolutely.
For Linux, so you can do 97 things with one command.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I do for my installations is I just write down the commands, including install the following, and then I just cut and paste them into my they're in a word processor document, and I just cut and paste them into my terminal, and then it just installs everything I need. But But you know, you could go through the graphic manager and just you know, think, oh yeah, I want this, I want that, check them all and install them all one at a time. You know, it's more like strolling through a shopping mall rather than shopping online. But you know, I should emphasize that for anyone who's thinking about switching to Linux or trying it out, there's absolutely no need to use the command line for pretty much anything. And you know, you can do everything from graphical software these days.
Tom mentions if you're into compiling, there's the Gen 2 compiler. Alan mentions that another option for 32-bit Linux, he wrote a review of lc.pdf is the document that it ends up on. I presume it's actually called LC.
Not familiar with that, but as I said, there's a distribution for anybody.
Yeah, right.
Now
Okay.
that's the Debian edition of Linux Mint.
Okay.
LDME.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
Okay, and Tristan also
LNGME.
mentions that you can use Flatpak to install applications across any Linux distro, and he includes the URL to their site.
Yeah, well, if you just to touch on distribution formats, there's a bunch of different formats used for Linux. Most of the repositories are full, like particularly in the Ubuntu and Debian side of the house, are what's called deb files, which were designed for Debian. And most of Ubuntu, for instance, is made up of Debian files. But Flatpaks are another way of getting specific application software. And once you've installed Flatpak, you can go and get those. It's sort of a separate repository of stuff that's on Flatpak. On their website that you can download and install automatically. A couple of years ago, Ubuntu created a sort of a competitive format called Snap, which for instance, when you install Ubuntu these days, it comes with a Thunderbird email client and it comes with Firefox, but they're already installed as Snap packages. And Mozilla directly updates those, so you get your updates much more quickly. Flatpak and Snap are both similar. You can actually run both different versions of the same software at the same time. But you can also I know people run entire systems just using deb files. So there's a number of ways of doing that. A lot of them are just to try and avoid problems with dependencies and that kind of stuff.
I misinterpreted Tom's comment on Gentoo. He says Gentoo is a Linux distribution in source code only. You compile it for your hardware, 32 or 64-bit. So if you're into rolling your own.
There's a reason why I didn't include Gentoo in my list of Linux distributions you should know about. It's kind of a famous distribution. He's right. It's extremely hard to install it, and it's remained extremely hard to install it over the years for a reason. The users on there don't like answering questions from newbies. And so Gentoo is the kind of distribution that sort of advanced Linux users who are developers use, and it's almost like a prestige item. It's like, what do you use? Oh, I use Gentoo. It's like, okay, I won't ask anything else. I've only met one person who was a Gentoo user, and they were a window manager developer. So yeah, and I would say, you know, if you're a software developer, that's probably the one you already know about. And if you're a beginner, stay away from that one because you'll never install it. There's much easier ones to do than that. So,
All right.
well, again, it comes back to what I said before. There's a distribution for everybody, right?
Yeah,
So
right.
if you're an extremely experienced Linux developer, you're probably already using Gentoo. And if you're not, you don't need to know about
Yeah.
it.
Okay, I've gotten to the end of the chat, so if anybody has anything else they want to ask or anything, you can either throw it in the chat or unmute yourself and ask it. And while we're waiting to see if anything else does come on, we did have a number of kudos and thank yous in the chat for your presentation, Adam, so that was much appreciated. I think it was real eye-opener even for me who has, although I don't run Linux, I knew a fair amount about it, but I didn't know as much as I know now.
There's always
And
more
so,
everyone can
thank
learn.
you.
I mean, one
Yeah,
of the things as
exactly.
a reviewer is I spend a lot of time learning stuff. I'm by no means a Linux expert. I'm not a developer. You know, I'm just a volunteer reviewer. But every time I do a review, I learn something because I have to dig into things and try and figure out what they are. And it kind of forces you to learn more. And I think one of the big things about Linux is it's a lot of fun. Like it's, you know, I saw a poster years ago said, "Does your operating system make you laugh out loud?" Well, sometimes it does, you know, you just feel good about using it. So yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad that some people got some things out of this, and I hope, you know, it'll encourage people to just, you know, get the shovel out and start digging around and see what kind of free software you can find. And if you're going to stick with Mac or Windows, by all means, dig around and see what kind of free software is available for your uses. Like whether you're doing a remodeling of your home or just looking for a better web browser, there's free software solutions to all of that.
Yeah, I certainly use a few of the use KeePass on my Android phone as well as Windows computers, and I use VLC and I use Firefox and so Thunderbird. So I certainly do use an awful lot of the free software that is running under Windows. So with that, we are just a little past the 9 o'clock. So I'd like to thank Adam a lot for his presentation tonight. It was really great. The files that he mentioned, the presentation file as well as the resource list, they are already on our web server just waiting for Bridget to do her magic to put up the links to it. So mm-hmm. I'm sure if you check in the next couple of days, if you wanted to download either of those, they will be available on our website. So thanks again, Adam, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as everybody else did.
Yeah, no, it was great fun. I'll leave you with one last thought, which my editor, Rana, you would like me to say. Check out Full Circle Magazine, free PDF or EPUB downloads. And it's a magazine mostly aimed at beginners. I certainly aim my reviews at people who have no experience with Linux. My fiance edits all my articles, and she's a Mac user. She doesn't know Linux at all. And so I make sure when I write my reviews that she can understand it. And and we have cartoons and everything in the magazine. It's a fun magazine, and there's a lot of how-tos, and a lot of stuff is, you know, the sort of thing that beginners would find interesting. So have a look at it, download the latest issue, and have a flip through it. It's all free. It's a PDF. You don't even have to figure out how to recycle it when you're done.
Yeah. And for anybody interested in the chat, Tom has pasted in the link to the fullcirclemagazine.org. URL, so you can pick it up there, or I'm sure that your favorite search engine could find it as well.
It's also in my list of links, in my PDF list of links. I put it in there. Great. I knew my editor would want me to.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. Okay, thanks again.
No problem. Anytime.
Okay, take care. Okay, good night all, and we will see a bunch of you, I hope, at Q&A next week.